This podcast is brought to you by TECH, the Therapeutics Education Collaboration, evidence-based drug therapy made practical and fun.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of the Therapeutics Education Collaboration podcast. My name is James McCormack, as always, and I'm coming to you from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And this is a special treat, I hope, for everybody today. We have an interview with Ben Goldacre, who I'm sure some of the people who listen to the podcast know of Ben. He's a British physician and science writer, and he's known quite well for a couple of publications, a book called Bad Science, where he critiques sort of the irrationality and a whole bunch of stuff about alternative medicine and tries to get people to think about science. And just recently put out a book in Canada and States called Bad Pharma, where he looks at the whole pharmaceutical industry and the publishing and marketing practices and so on and how it all works. And I thought I'd just let you know, Ben, that a colleague and friend of mine saw a TED Talk and that you did, and I saw it as well. And he said, you should really check this guy out. And he says, because that if you and I had a race, it'd be a tie. And I think it has to do with our sort of ADHD style of skeptical presentation. So welcome.
Oh, thanks. I think that's really good. The thing that frustrates me about podcasts is not being able to speed them up. So maybe we can satisfy people who require a high data throughput.
Yeah, or we'll just do two times. We'll just multiply it. There are a lot of settings we can do that for. And also one of the things I loved about you, I saw a line about you saying that your favorite leisure activity is meeting people who disagree with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm interested in reasonable disagreement. And sometimes when you write thoughtfully and critically about the evidence for somebody's claims, you get unreasonable disagreement. You get people having tantrums.
Yeah. But
then that in turn produces color. And, you know, there are lots of traditions around how to engage the public in science that I kind of disagree with. Like people say that you always have to make it about stories or make it about you or make it about going on a journey. But I actually think conflict is quite a good hook for talking about things, especially because conflict is really at the core of real science. You know, people do spend their time in science critically appraising the evidence for somebody else's position. So it's not an effort or a crowbar job. You know, that is what science is about. But anyway, sorry, that's it.
No, totally. Because I'm sure you've probably had the experience, like 95% of the time I do this, people are very friendly and courteous and both groups learn. But you get about the 5% of people who are kind of jerks.
Yeah, but also actually, it's interesting, isn't it? It's wrong to sort of lay down rules about how people should talk about science and evidence. But it's certainly my impression that when people are fluent with the ideas, they speak candidly and directly. Whenever I hear somebody speaking in a very overly technical, cautious, flowery, or kind of political way, I often as not think, I'm not sure you really feel this in your belly. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, totally. Yeah, no.
People wade in and go, oh, UKPDS was rubbish. They confused the observation and the intervention data and the effect size wasn't that big anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of when you go, actually, I think you probably get it. But anyway,
yeah.
Again, distraction.
No, it's all good. So what I'd like to do is just quickly run by a few things, because I know there's some things that are really important to you and I think also important to the whole concept of disseminating of information. So why don't you let people just quickly know about the alltrials.net, because it's going gangbusters, and just give them sort of the Coles Notes version of what that is.
I wrote a book called Bad Pharma, which is about drug companies behaving badly, but also about how the whole information architecture of evidence-based medicine isn't as great as we imagine it to be. So there's this big sort of ecosystem of problems. We have trials which are often flawed by design. We have biased dissemination. And the biggest problem of all, to me, is that we let trials go missing in action. So the best currently available evidence, which comes from a systematic review in 2010, summarizing dozens of studies, there's no room for cherry picking here. The best currently available evidence suggests that overall, only about half the trials for the medicines that we use today have been published, and trials with positive results are about twice as likely to be published as trials with negative results. And it's also clear that everything that people have tried to fix this has failed. So there was a regulation from journal editors saying we'll only publish trials when they've been properly registered on a publicly accessible registry. And everybody said, oh, fantastic, everything's been fixed. But then there's a paper in JAMA a couple of years later showing actually that law, that regulation was basically ignored. Similarly, there's legislation saying you have to post results to clinicaltrials.gov of any trial within a year of completion. And when there was no routine public audit when one was finally done, published in the BMJ, one of the top five journals in the world, in 2012, it turned out the rate of compliance with that legislation was 22%. So this is clearly an ongoing problem. And actually, even if either of those two fixes had worked, they wouldn't really do anything to improve medicine today, because about 85% of all of the medicines that we use are generic. So they came on the market more than 10 years ago. And that kind of shows you the extent to which we need the results of trials from not just 2008 onwards, but 2003, 1999, 1995, 1991. So we need retrospective disclosure to get all of the evidence that we need to inform the decisions that doctors and patients are making today, because you need all of the evidence to make a decision. Carry on.
Well, and that makes a ton of sense, because you know, one of the sort of messages that we try to get out on this podcast is that it's actually quite unusual that a new medication really should be started any much earlier than about 5 years before it's been on the market. So really, almost all of the medications that people are using today, we really need that full level of evidence.
It's really interesting, isn't it? It's one of the sort of tick list things that you can use to spot a clueful prescriber, I think, is are they cautious about prescribing new medicines, or are they gung-ho and think they're fabulous? Because with very new medicines, I suspect you were alluding to this, you don't have very long experience of the side effects, and it's quite difficult to detect side effects in the very small numbers of people that you get in randomized trials before a drug comes to market. And you also often only have outcome data on surrogate outcomes like blood tests rather than real world outcomes like heart attack or death. So I agree. I mean, it's often more sensible to use slightly older medicines. And also, there was a fantastic Cochrane review. It's in the most recent edition, I think, by Ben Jilbegovic and a couple of others, where they looked at a really simple question, which was just, when a new medicine is compared to an old medicine, what are the chances that the new one turns out to be better? And the answer is just over even. It's about 51-52%. So actually, although we fetishize new medicines in our practice often, overall, the chances of something new being better are actually pretty marginal.
Yeah, and in fact, I'd add that it's, and depends on what me sort of mean by better, because I sat on a thing called the Patented Medicine Prices Review Board here in Canada, where we looked at all of the new medications that came on the market, and we've done that over the last 10 or 15 years. And we were asked, is it a substantial improvement? Not, is it just tweaking a little bit better? And it's about 5%, and it's about two new drugs every year are a substantial improvement, and one of those is for conditions people have never even heard of. So we're looking at one new drug every year that really clinicians need to know about.
And we shouldn't poo-poo this rate of progress. I mean,
no.
It's not as if people aren't trying. It's just that we have to be realistic about it and make sure that it's communicated clearly to doctors and, I think, to patients. But also, I think it's important to be clear. You know, if you look at mortality tables, your chances of dying as a middle-aged man over the past three or four decades have roughly halved, but that's not because of any single epoch-making breakthrough. It's not because we've discovered something as spectacular as smoking causes cancer and heart disease. It's because of a gradual accumulation of lots of very modest changes in risks and benefits of positive outcomes. And overall, that adds up to your chances of dying as a middle-aged man have halved in 30 or 40 years, but that wasn't because of any single amazing thing. And I think that kind of expectation management, or that kind of realism about what we can expect, is important, and also should inform our practice, because it seems to me that the greatest gains for population health are to be found in optimizing clinical care and optimizing the use of the evidence and the treatments that we already have. And actually getting access to all of the withheld data, I think, is a really important part of that.
Yeah, and I think if we could have our patients appreciate that too, because they come in with expectations that are well above what we can probably provide.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because it's the role of a clinician to provide reassurance and contain anxiety as much as it is to hand over specific treatments. But yes, it's a very, very interesting dance, really. What do we promise? What do we offer? And how do we style it? I think it's right for us to be positive with patients. But we have to be cautious about the specifics of what we promise and what we say. Yeah.
And I know one of the things, even if people could just look at the available evidence that we have now, if they could look at it in a critical way, they would find out that antidepressants don't really work all that way. That statins reduce heart disease by 1-2% if there's primary prevention. So even if it is really important to get all that information, but we do actually have a fair amount of useful information that we can make decisions with if people were able to sort of critically appraise it. At least that's my sort of concept.
Right. Well, and what you've described there are the simple bits. I think actually what's really interesting is how bad we are at disseminating evidence to decision makers. We spend tens and hundreds of millions of dollars on just doing one trial. And yet we kind of drop the ball when it comes to the second important step of synthesizing all that evidence together, getting it to the right clinician, the right patient at the right time, making sure people aren't overwhelmed with inappropriate information, but at the same time, making sure that they get information that's relevant to help them make decisions. And I mean, I would, if you put me in charge of the world research budget, which is very unlikely to happen, obviously, I would cancel all primary trials research for 1 year, because I think we could live for a year without one more trial comparing one MS treatment against another or one asthma treatment against another. Just for 1 year, I'd put that stuff on hold, and I'd invest everything we have on better systems for synthesizing, disseminating, and implementing the evidence that we already have. And it's strange to me how that's often regarded as a rather inferior second cousin. You sometimes get kind of slightly disappointing prescribing advisor projects where they sort of go, oh, what happens if we get a hospital pharmacist to visit some local nursing homes? Can we reduce polypharmacy in the elderly? But other than that, it always feels very ad hoc and unjoined up. You get people doing things very manually, producing guidelines or manual summaries. But automated systems for decision support, I think, it should be a huge priority. And if we invested as much in that as we do in individual trials, I think we'd have huge gains for the population, not so much in saving money, actually, but more in, I mean, actually, to be honest, probably also in uptake of genuinely beneficial, innovative, expensive new medicines. But anyway, sorry, we should just finish the alltrials.net story.
Yeah.
I did this book on problems in the way that evidence-based medicine runs called Bad Pharma. And after it came out, it was really interesting, actually, just to watch what happened, because I've written critically about misuses of evidence by government, by PR people, by journalists, by quacks, by anti-vaccination conspiracy theorists, and by drug companies for many, many years. It's a real kind of test of character, I suppose. How do people respond when you go, hey, I'm not sure that's right? And some of the responses from industry were much more childish than I expected, actually. There were some very senior people from industry saying, well, the ABPI, the UK pharmaceutical industry, put out a press release saying all of these problems are historic and they have all been fixed,
which is a level of absurdity.
It's dazzlingly untrue, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
People from American sort of industry have said the same things since. And it's amazing to see the level of sort of chutzpah and insightlessness and it's just so extreme. One really striking example is there have been a couple of people who've said, oh, it's outrageous to say that sometimes trials are flawed by design. Now, in the book, I'm not trying to sort of flog the book, by the way. I'm just sort of saying, to illustrate how the conversation.
Well, I think the evidence might go against you on this one.
I describe really well-known recurring design flaws in clinical trials, like, for example, switching the primary outcome between the protocol and the end of the study. So essentially data dredging, increasing your chances of getting a positive result. I talk about early stopping and late stopping. I talk about trials which use a comparator that's not really very informative. So sometimes in extreme cases, people compare their new treatment against an inadequate dose of the competitor drug. But also there's a real problem with people comparing new drugs against dummy placebo sugar pills, which actually some regulators force them to, even when there's a currently available treatment, which is very uninformative.
But anyway, which is an interesting concept, because I also sit on a clinical research ethics board.
Yeah.
When it comes to that sort of stuff, and you know, there are certain people who are dead set against placebo-controlled trials of certain things. And I think one of the key things, though, is more, and I'd love your sort of opinion on this, is as long as we properly inform patients about the risks and benefits. That in and of itself is tricky at the best of times. But, you know, it is possible to do sometimes to do placebo-controlled trials, even if there is effective therapy available.
It's very, very difficult. I mean, it comes down to all of the complexities of the doctor-patient relationship. What do people hear when they hear a professional speaking to them? And is it what that professional has actually said? You know, rheumatoid arthritis drugs being compared against placebo when there's a currently available disease-modifying agent.
Yeah, in that case, I think it's inappropriate, yeah. Because the concerns about not treating are much higher than, you know.
They happen. There's a paper from 2012 summarizing kind of, you know, a large number of trials where people are deprived of disease-modifying agents in rheumatoid arthritis. So they happen, and you know, people try and work around it. You say, well, you only get a placebo for a short time. But even so, I wouldn't be a patient in those trials. And I find it hard to understand why somebody would be, unless it's that amazing and very giving aspect to clinical trial participation, which is, you know, I want to improve knowledge for patients in the same predicament as me in the future, which is actually one reason why I think it's so unpleasant, really, as well as unethical to leave the results of clinical trials unpublished, because trial participants are owed a duty of courtesy and care and respect by all of us who run clinical trials. And actually, when you tell people that they're participating in a trial to inform future care and then you don't publish the results, I think that's a real betrayal of trial participants.
Oh, it's a huge, very unethical, I think.
But anyway, in any case, you know, I wrote about these very well-documented design flaws in clinical trials, which are so well recognized that they're taught to undergraduates on medical courses. I'm sure you'd have to be taught them to get a DPharm degree like the one that you teach. And, you know, this stuff is at the core of the medical curriculum, really. So to see people from, the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Medicine or the pharmaceutical industry stand up and say, oh, this is a ridiculous thing to say. It's a bit like denying that the kidney exists. I mean, you know, how can you say it's ridiculous to say that trials are sometimes badly designed? That's what I was teaching medical students just yesterday.
It's
in all the medical textbooks. And it's peculiar to see how angsty people get at the prospect of having an honest conversation with the public about the shortcomings in the way that we gather evidence in medicine. Because actually, I think we need the public's help on a lot of these things. We were going to talk about the pragmatic trials later, weren't we? But I think that's a really clear example, actually, of, you know, we're constantly coming up against situations of clinical uncertainty in medicine. It's more common than not, I would say, that when a doctor makes a prescribing decision, they don't know which is the best treatment for that patient at that time. You know, there are almost always, I would say, in almost every clinical encounter, there is unresolved uncertainty about some aspect of the treatment. It may not be, does this stuff work or not, but it's quite likely to be which of the five drugs in this class is the best.
Yeah, and that's actually leads with the issue about getting, when new drugs are put on the market, it's against placebo versus against what the gold standard is and what's the best treatment. And if we could somehow, it's often the research is outstanding, but they've just asked the wrong question.
Yeah, and actually there was a fantastic paper in New England Journal in 2011, which just looked very simply at every single drug approved by the FDA from 2000 to 2010 and asked a simple question: was this drug compared against anything other than placebo at the time when it was approved? And was there a currently available effective treatment? And it turned out that for newly approved drugs, where there was a currently available treatment, 30% of them at time of approval had only been compared against placebo. And that's, I mean, it's shocking and hopeless, and you'd hope that clinicians wouldn't use drugs when there's such weak evidence. But at the same time, I think there are a lot of people around who have this kind of rather thoughtless view that anything that's been approved by a regulator is somehow worth using, when in reality the bar is very low.
No, and I think people think that they must have a huge advantage. All the regulatory bodies are saying is that, you know, it has an effect and probably won't kill everybody.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I guess they're saying it's probably better than nothing.
Yes.
And I think better than nothing is actually at the core of all of this. Our lack of ambition and our lack of ambition to have absolute clarity about which is the best treatment at every step of the way in medicine has cost uncountably huge numbers of lives. And we can be very easily lulled into a false sense of security in medicine, I think, by the fact that most of what we do does at least do some good. And so we let ourselves off the hook of doing the absolute best that we can for our patients. For example, if one drug will save 6 lives out of 10 and the other will save 8 lives out of 10, sometimes doctors will be persuaded to use the inferior drug, the one that only saves 6 lives out of 10, through a combination of unflattering results from clinical trials being withheld, bad trial design, and aggressive marketing. Now, sometimes when you talk to the public about these kinds of problems, people will say, well, that's outrageous, because they can see very clearly that the net cost there is 2 lives. That's avoidable mortality and morbidity, which is what we say when we're being polite. It's avoidable suffering and death. But at the same time, we have to explain, how is it that people in industry, publishing, medicine, and so on can feel kind of okay about themselves when they participate in systems that permit evidence to be obfuscated and fail to treat those problems with the same degree of urgency that we would treat a patient who's having a cardiac arrest in an emergency room? And I think it's because everything we do does some good. You know, the person who's pushing a drug that saves 6 lives out of 10, despite the fact that they know that there is a better drug that saves 8 lives out of 10, can sleep easy at night because they just go, well, hey, I'm selling this stuff. It's great. It saves 6 lives out of 10. You award yourself a point for the benefit without being aware of the opportunity cost. And the opportunity costs in medicine are really significant. And it's very strange how difficult it is to get some people to accept that and how easy it is for the public to immediately comprehend.
Yeah. And as you're talking, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, any drug that saves 6 out of 10 lives. I mean, other than maybe adrenaline.
6 out of 100 and 8 out of 100. But you know, somebody had a tantrum the other day, so that was experimental. It's the first time I've ever used out of 10. And I think I'd probably agree.
Yeah, because I know, I don't know, this is, and it's something that we were, just before we started recording the podcast, I was going to talk to you. So one of the things I'd like to do is talk to you about guidelines, because it's something that I follow very closely, especially guidelines for blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes. And I think we've gotten to the point where I don't know if we can do much more benefit, because I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but in the last 3 to 4 years, there have been 15 studies in a row, and these are large randomized controlled trials, thousands of patients looking at morbidity and mortality. 15 studies in a row have shown that the intervention, which was to either lower glucose, cholesterol, or blood pressure, 15 in a row have shown no benefit or harm, which is quite shocking to me.
Well, I don't know which interventions you're talking about, but
it's things like, you know, niacin, fibrates, aliskiren, insulin, all sorts of, you know, in the literally 15 studies, there hasn't been one positive trial in the last, I think, 3 or 4 years that shows a benefit of lowering, at least with the therapies that we've used for glucose and cholesterol. Now, that's not to suggest that, you know, people with really big numbers don't get a benefit, but once we're getting down to those very small numbers where almost everybody, you know, has blood pressures above 120 over 80.
Okay, so you're talking about primary prevention. So you're saying we haven't had very impressive progress in primary prevention for common conditions.
Well, we did when we were treating blood pressures of 200/120, but now we're trying to, you know, we've got the whole concepts of pre-hypertension and pre-diabetes, which are really, I don't know, I'm pretty skeptical about even those terms, let alone anything else.
Okay, so when you said guidelines, I thought you meant like the whole principle of guidelines in general, and I think that's a really interesting area actually, because there have been lots of fantastic, scary evidence reviews where people basically go, okay, let's give you a score out of 10 for how evidence-based your guidelines are. And actually very commonly, guidelines for all kinds of problems, including sort of, you know, big major things where we know that what we do has a significant impact. Very commonly, they turn out to be based in eminence as much as evidence. And that's kind of, that's disturbing. And especially once you get to kind of the third step in, you know, when people haven't got better on the most common treatments, things rapidly deteriorate into opinion.
I don't know if you've seen it, but there's two reviews of guidelines just recently that came out. One was for the Infectious Disease Society, I think in America, and the other one was for cardiovascular disorders. And they identified that I think it was 10% of recommendations are actually based on, you know, randomized controlled trials. 50% of the recommendations are purely opinion.
It's quite dizzying as well. I mean, so one of the things I think that's interesting in medicine is it's a very frightening business, right? People are dying, people are suffering. You're trying to do your best. There's something very anxiolytic about social structures. They help us feel, they help buffer us from the reality of the gravity of the human situations that we're dealing with. And I remember the first time I read a paper that assessed the quality of evidence for a set of clinical guidelines that I had used. And I remember going, oh, crikey. So, you know, what is there now? You know, especially because it was the guidelines that I would, that I'd really reach for when I was on call, you know, 3-4 in the morning. What do I do now? And I noticed that I continued to move. I continued to refer to them afterwards. And I often wondered why. You know, I mean, it was partly they were the best bet. Partly they did have some sense in them, but also partly I think it was that nobody could say you're hopeless if you had at least done what the guidelines said. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, in medicine, the stakes are so high, and we're constantly zooming in and out from the micro to the macro, that actually there's a social value in guidelines, that in the way that they can make us feel like they can stop us going mad about just how difficult and uncertain a lot of medicine is. And I think part of the challenge for modern medicine is to find a path between the security blanket of slightly false certainty that we get from guidelines, from the oral traditions of medicine, and then at the same time constantly forcing ourselves to really confront uncertainty and resolve it. So to really go, look, you know, by the time we get to the third step in asthma treatment in primary care, we don't really know what we're doing, and you know, we might as well be making it up as we go along, and we need to do a trial. And I think flicking back and forth between not going completely mad from the sort of wild uncertainty of everything and embracing uncertainty and doing something coherent to address it is a really important and interesting dynamic in medicine. And I think part of the reason why we're so afraid of uncertainty is we've been very bad at systematically identifying the situations where evidence is lacking in the decision trees of medicine, and also in deploying appropriate resources to resolve that uncertainty by doing big, simple, pragmatic, randomized trials in routine clinical care.
And I think if family physicians primarily, because they're right at the interface of most of the decisions that go on in many people's lives, I think if they were made aware that there is a certain level of uncertainty, in my experience working with them, they actually can deal with that. You know, they work with the patient in front of them, and you know, we don't want everything to be uncertain, but we also don't want it to appear that everything is completely certain either.
That's absolutely true. Although there's then a second step, because once clinicians have embraced that and really feel it in their belly, we then have to move on to communicating that honestly to patients. And that's a real preoccupation of mine, because we need to have patients on board and understanding the fact that we know some things about what works best, but we don't have all the answers yet, and that we need their help. So I'm very struck by the fact that we could really turn medicine into a machine that's constantly testing and learning and adapting. For example, we're running a trial at the moment, or at least we're trying to, in routinely collected electronic health records in the UK. And the idea here is there's never been a trial that compares one statin against another at the commonly prescribed doses. So there have been some trials of very, very dramatic high doses against low doses. But we haven't really done a trial where we just go, okay, there's a few statins on the market. Which one is the best at the doses at which they're normally prescribed in normal clinical care for normal everyday patients, you know, chap in his 50s, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, family history. And it's extraordinary to me that the barriers to, so what we'd like to do is just, you know, pretty much whenever a patient goes to be prescribed a statin, since we don't know which is best, when the doctor tries to prescribe it on their computer, a screen comes up and it goes, wait, we don't know which statin is the best. Press this big red button here to randomly assign your patient to one or the other, and we'll collect all the follow-up data from routinely collected electronic health records. You'll never have to think about it again. And the idea is we can do a trial on the scale of, for example, the ALLHAT trial, which was a few thousand people for almost a decade and cost $120 million. But now with electronic health records, we get all of our follow-up data for free. So you can run a trial like that for about $500,000. And that's an extraordinary thing, because it lowers the price of information. And we know that the value of information is high, because if one statin turned out to be just a little bit better than the other, and for example, you know, a statin that interferes with CRP in some interesting and exotic way may well be one where we might think, well, hey, this is worth thinking about. You know, maybe this one is better. Maybe it's not just about lowering your cholesterol. So,
But really, if we're talking about sort of for primary prevention, they could only, you know, one statin versus another could only possibly be maybe 1% better.
Well, I'm not sure about that, actually. It's
why?
Possible it could be a slightly more dramatic benefit, but in absolute risk terms, you're absolutely
that,
right.
That, no, that's exactly what I mean. In saying that because that's...
You need very large numbers, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's important to do them as cheaply and efficiently as possible. So the reason why I brought this up is, you know, we were talking about getting doctors to recognize that there's uncertainty, for example, about which statin is best at normal doses. Now, even if doctors appreciate that, we need doctors to be able to have an honest conversation with their patients where they say, look, I think you need a statin, but we actually don't really know which one's best at the moment. So I'd like to randomly assign you to one or the other, and then we'll find out in maybe five.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Actually, I hadn't thought, because I've read a little bit about some of the stuff that you do with, you're talking about with this pragmatic randomized trial, and I hadn't thought that it allows the conversation with the patient to sort of have a discussion about that uncertainty. It adds an extra value, although I think if I remember...
Well, you call it value. I would say it's a barrier, because it's a new and difficult thing for a lot of doctors to be able to say honestly to their patient, I don't know which is best. And it's not that doctors are incompetent and can't do it. Of course they can. It's just another kind of sort of challenging clinical encounter, like breaking bad news or trying to talk somebody around from wanting sleeping pills. It's a communication skills challenge. And I think it's one that we need to be, that we need to be really working on, because actually, to my mind, and this is a reasonably radical idea, but it's one that you know is shared by a lot of people. I think unless a new medicine has been shown to be dramatically better than everything we already have, I think you can make quite a strong argument that, for example, on the NHS, the fabulous socialist utopia of our British health system, that new medicines should only be available in the context of a randomized trial up until the point at which they have demonstrated that they really are beneficial over what we already have. And I don't think that's even slightly unreasonable. I mean, if it was me as a patient and I went along to a doctor and they said, look, we've got a new treatment or an old treatment, nobody knows which is best. The new one might be a little bit better. It looks like it's better on, you know, maybe sort of blood test results in the short term. If you want to give it a go, that's great, but it's on the government's randomize me scheme. And I think I'd probably say, yeah, sure, stick me in. And so the doctor types in my patient ID number and I get randomized. It's a 50-50 chance whether I get whatever the normal current treatment was for that condition or whether I get the new one. And actually, I think that being really brutal, not to patients, but really, really brutal with the data, being really brutal about minimizing the duration of time in which clinical practice is riddled with uncertainty, should be a huge public health priority, because nobody benefits from getting a new treatment if we don't know whether it's better or worse than what we already have. They might think they're benefiting, but they're certainly not. They could be receiving a more harmful treatment, because that happens. And when I say harmful, I mean because it's less good. So I think, firstly, medicine would be improved if we were much clearer about documenting uncertainty wherever it exists. And that requires that guidelines are very honest about where the evidence stops and where the personal opinion begins, because that's a useful source of research questions. Then secondly, I think patients and doctors need to be much better about helping society to resolve those issues for the good of patients, and not just patients in the future. You know, if I'm on a statin, I'm going to be on it for 20 years. If we find out one's better or worse in 5 years, then I benefit too. But lastly, I think all of this is particularly important now as we enter an era of medicine which, and you've expressed some anxiety about this, an era of medicine in which we're engaging in primary prevention on things like diabetes, where the time delay between the intervention and the outcome is very, very long. So, for example, if we look at new diabetes medications, I don't understand why a new diabetes medication comes to market with data on 2,000 or 3,000 people and is then just sort of used rather haphazardly. It seems to me that as a basic minimum, every single one of the patients of the 3,000 patients in the trials that got that drug to market, just from showing that it's able to lower blood sugar, those patients should be followed up for the whole of the rest of their lives, so that we can try to detect a signal in the long term outcomes.
I would totally agree, and I think the glucose lowering is a wonderful example, because we keep getting complications associated with not doing those sorts of clinical trials. I mean, we're still to the point where we have metformin, and many of these new medications that are on the market are constant. Well, the glitazones are a wonderful example of where we totally screwed those up, I think, by not doing exactly as you're suggesting.
Well, and when you look at glitazones, the FDA's requirement now for getting a diabetes drug on the market is, if I remember rightly, the upper limit of the confidence interval for whether it causes cardiovascular disease is 1.4, it might have been 1.6. And you kind of go, well, wow, you know, if I'm taking diabetic medication, it's not because I care what my blood sugar is, it's actually because I want to stop myself having heart problems.
Well, no, I've always found it funny. You'll hear reports of things like the glitazone saying, you know, we found out that they don't increase the risk of heart attacks. But you're giving them to reduce the chance of heart attacks.
Quite. And so I think we need to, you know, that I think is you know, it comes close to being a slightly Alice in Wonderland-ish illustration of how we can have an awful lot of faith in surrogate outcomes and really drop the ball on concrete real world outcomes like heart attack and death. But also it shows how our current systems for regulatory approval, but then also health technology appraisal by bodies like NICE or payers, and also decision making, but also even patents, are perhaps rather ill-suited to medicines where their intention is to have a benefit after 10 years of use, because it means that the benefits only start to plop out of the research at around about the time that the drug traditionally would be coming off patent. So I actually wonder if there's some kind of interesting work to be done there with, and what we're really talking about is a form of adaptive licensing here. In fact, you know, adaptive licensing designs are so up for grabs and poorly described that I suppose it's not a form of adaptive licensing. Our cobbled together in a podcast description of adaptive licensing is probably what anyone else is right now. But I think actually we may need to look at sort of saying, well, if you're going to play ball and be sensible and consistent and coherent and determined about resolving uncertainty with your new medicine, then if it's seeking to reduce a long-term outcome, I think maybe we should be flexible about patent duration, actually, because I'm worried that in the rush to get new drugs on the market and taken up for things like diabetes, we may be incentivizing people to expose patients to treatments which actually aren't that awesome. And again, not because they're sort of evil, malevolent people, but just because it's you know, people in industry in particular tend to be rule followers. And when you get into squabbles with them, you really start to learn that. I mean, there's a whole community of kind of barrow boys, really, in the pharmaceutical industry, who, when you raise these kinds of concerns about the shortcomings in the evidence that we use and how we use it, they just start shouting about, you know, I do everything that the FDA tells me to. And you kind of go, well, yeah, but actually what we're talking about here is whether these legacy systems, which we've worked with for a long time, many of which were designed to detect whether a new antibiotic saved lives over the course of 7 days and whether it killed you over the course of a year after. Maybe those models aren't actually very useful. And you know, it's trivially true to say that they're in flux. So, you know, let's involve the public in that discussion.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And so what you're sort of suggesting is that if you're putting out a drug that, you know, we probably wouldn't be able to figure out whether there was a true cardiovascular benefit for 10 years, maybe the patent protection should go on longer than that, as long as you know, at the upfront, you start to enroll people in these in sort of the either very clearly designed randomized controlled trials or even the pragmatic ones that you're talking about. But I guess
but also I would hope that you could have a kind of trade off where you could say, look, if we give you 15 years after it comes to market rather than 10 to exploit the patent, then how about for the first 5 years, instead of rolling it out to absolutely everybody you possibly can with an aggressive marketing strategy, you only make it available in the context of RCTs with comprehensive follow-up of real-world outcomes to a slightly smaller number of punters. And that, I think, you know, meets the challenge of how can we resolve uncertainty whilst always minimizing harm, and by minimizing the amount of time large numbers of patients are exposed to treatments where there is a lesser quantity of good information.
Yeah. And I think it's really important that it's not actually the fault of the drug industry often in this case. I mean, like exactly saying, they're following the guidelines that are put out by the FDA. And also, you've talked about this before in regards to the Ethics Review Board. I mean, it's a nightmare. I can imagine it'd be a nightmare for these sort of pragmatic randomized trials to get every IRB to do, you know, to deal with this issue, because it's very, very tricky. And I mean, I have sat on ethics review boards, and it'd be great if we could sort of have a national ethics review board for this type of clinical trial, so that you could get it done in an expedited fashion, if you will.
Well, I mean, I think for brand new medicines, the issues are slightly different. What I find remarkable is the huge and very disproportionate amount of oversight that is focused on trials comparing commonly used treatments, which have already been taken by millions of people around the world and are already known to be safe and effective. It's just that we don't know which is best. I mean, the idea that you need a very melodramatic sort of ethics committee, IRB oversight to compare one statin against another is absolutely bizarre, given that tens of millions of people take them and we know they're safe and effective. We just don't know which is best. So I think you're right. There's a real problem of what's proportionate. And it's interesting talking to ethicists about this, actually, if you can find one who's willing to have a serious conversation about it. I mean, there's a reluctance in that whole community, which I think is a sad thing. But there's a bit of a reluctance to meet a simple challenge, if you like, which is, you know, can you show me the evidence that you're doing good by holding up trials like these? You know, what is the harm that you're seeking to prevent? What is the evidence that this harm is prevalent? And what's the evidence that your activities reduce it, and that you do more good than harm? But also, it's difficult to get people to justify what has been called research exceptionalism. So the idea that when you give a statin, nobody cares. You just say, here's a statin. The conversation about side effects maybe lasts 30 seconds to 3 minutes, depending on who the doctor is. Whereas when you give a statin, one statin or another in the context of a randomized trial, suddenly the conversation is 20 minutes long. And getting people to justify why that's important at all, whether it's in terms of evidence for the harm that they're preventing, or whether it's in terms of some kind of more abstract philosophical benefit, it's very difficult.
And it may be, I guess, partly because of the way, you know, even with the whole push towards sort of shared informed decision making, where, you know, even that is very, very difficult, because it's not just about letting patients know about the risks and this long list of side effects and so on and so forth. It's really the whole interaction with their healthcare provider that they hopefully trust and respect, and it's so complicated.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, there's a huge amount going on in the background with all of these conversations. Yeah. So we didn't finish the alltrials.net story. Well,
please, but give the, why don't you try to finish it, if you will.
So, you know, along with all these other really interesting sort of flaws in the information architecture of evidence-based medicine, there's this sort of really big elephant in the room, which is, for the medicines we currently use, our best currently available estimate from a systematic review is that half trials don't go on to be published, and trials with positive results are twice as likely to be published as trials with negative results. So after Bad Pharma came out, I was actually amazed at how many people in sort of serious positions in the UK started taking it seriously. So some people behaved in, I think, a rather shameful fashion. But the Health Select Committee in the House of Parliament made sort of encouraging noises about the problem of missing data almost immediately. The Science and Technology Select Committee in the House of Parliament have announced that they're holding a special inquiry into the problem of missing clinical trial data. And we kind of realised that we also needed a campaign, because there were some people who rather irresponsibly were pretending that this problem doesn't exist, as I said, like the ABPI, the pharmaceutical industry body. And I feel that, you know, we failed as a profession to fix this problem behind closed doors. And actually, we need the help of the public. People often have a very patronising view of the public. You know, they'll be scared if you tell them about any of the problems in medicine. They won't understand things. They're ignorant. There's no point in talking with problems with them about problems in medicine. But actually, I mean, firstly, we failed to fix this ongoing problem, this ludicrous problem of half of all clinical trials going missing in action behind closed doors. And secondly, actually, the public are not an undifferentiated mess. I mean, I don't know how much time you spend talking to patients in your current role, but you know, my sort of main take-home message from seeing patients in very deprived areas of London over the course of a decade is that people basically are never stupid. I mean, in terms of basic intellectual horsepower, pretty much everyone is perfectly capable of understanding, you know, and pretty much anything once it's clearly explained to them. People vary a little in how motivated they are, how much they care. Actually, when people are sick, they often care quite a lot. But also, the public are not an amorphous mess. The public includes lawyers, policymakers, politicians, people who understand campaigning, people who understand culture change in organisations, and so on. And actually, talking to the public about this problem of missing trials, rather than talking to academics and doctors and regulators and industry people about it, suddenly made me realise that we hadn't tried any of the really basic things. So we've started a campaign for calling for three things at alltrials.net. And it's run by me, an organisation called Sense About Science, the British Medical Journal, Cochrane, and a patient representative, and Sir Ian Chalmers, who's one of the founders of the Cochrane Collaboration. And we're calling for really three things. We're calling for all trials going back to 1990, because that covers about 70% of all the medicines we use today. So it's not perfect, but it's a reasonable trade-off. For all trials going back to 1990, we want to know all the trials that have been done. We want people to tell us the results in brief summary form, and ideally where they exist. We want the full clinical study report. And we're happy without identifiable patient data. We're happy with what the European Medicines Agency tends to release on request for the small number of trials that they hold information on. So we're asking for those three things. And also we're asking people to recognize, you know, this is a problem. This problem exists and we need to do something about it. And it was very, very interesting to see how fast certain groups began to sign up. One thing that's very striking is the extent to which this was characterized really by patients leading professionals, which I actually am very okay with. So 81 patient groups signed up all at once, not very long after we started, including some absolutely huge ones, you know, Cancer Research UK, Macmillan Cancer Fund, really, you know, the great and the good of the patient community got on board really early on. And I was very, very impressed by that. Because patient groups, as I'm sure you know, do come in for some flack for taking money from industry, and they protest their independence. And I mean, the way I put it to them, really, when I met a group of patient groups was, I think it's fine to take money from industry. I think you should be transparent about how you declare it. But I think you also have to be certain that you're reflecting your members' needs. And drug companies do a lot of good, but they also withhold the results of clinical trials. And I think you should be the people who hold them to account for this, because my profession has failed. The patient groups were fantastic. They signed up almost immediately. We also early on got lots of support from people like Medical Research Council, the Wellcome Trust, who are the biggest UK funder of medical research. It would be wrong to say it's much later, because we've only been running for less than 2 months. Now we've got, Royal Colleges of Psychiatry, Royal Colleges of Paediatrics, the Royal College of GPs, which is our family doctors, they're about to sign up. And we've also, of course, got GSK. Everybody's very interested that we've got GSK whenever I do interviews about this. And I always feel a bit disappointed, because I feel like, well, patients are sort of as important and kind of... I felt a bit moved actually when a big group of patients signed up. But we also have GSK. So GlaxoSmithKline, one of the biggest drug companies in the world, certainly the biggest in the UK, and a company with a checkered history, of course, you know, $3 billion fine last year for acts of criminal and civil fraud, including some issues around sort of not being entirely forthcoming with clinical trial results. But a company that is trying to turn it around, and I feel reasonably confident that they're serious. And obviously the proof is always in the pudding, but I feel confident more because I spent kind of 45 minutes chatting with Andrew Whitty, who's the head of GSK. And I mean, he's not a warm man who laughs easily. He's very clever. He's a nice, very, very straight guy, you know, but he gives no quarter. And he asked very difficult questions, and it was clear that he'd thought very carefully about all this. And I don't say this for any reason other than to be clear that it wasn't like we rang up their press office and they said, oh, yeah, that'd look good if we did that. We had a serious conversation, and the questions that they were asking were about what exactly do you want, and you know, they were talking seriously about how they would prioritize work in particular areas, for example, where drugs are more commonly used, and so on. So, you know, I don't think it's stuff and nonsense. And so the reason for talking about this on here, I suppose, is firstly to say alltrials.net is currently, it's growing incredibly rapidly from being a largely UK thing, but we want it to be international. And it's now rapidly getting international support as well. So the European Public Health Association, who are exactly the kind of people who you would want and expect to sign up, got on board just last week. The National Physicians Alliance, who I think are the kind of less conservative American body, have signed up. But ICWIG, the German equivalent of NICE, their sort of health technology appraisal government body, have signed up. But we're very keen that as many people as possible from around the world sign up and pass the word on. So if anyone's listening, you know, you can sign in an individual capacity to alltrials.net. But do also click on the organisations page and click to get in touch with us and sign your organisation up, because it's only by having people like the Royal Pharmaceutical Society and the British Pharmacological Society and so on that we can sort of genuinely represent what I feel is the almost unanimous view amongst sensible, clueful people in medicine that this is a real important problem that we really need to fix.
Yeah, no, and it's actually brilliant what you've done. I think, you know, like you said, in just a couple of months, I think you've got something like over 40,000 people signed up, and I certainly know I have, because I think it's a very legitimate campaign, and it has the feel that where other ones have failed, this has maybe a better chance. And, you know, if we can get that sort of information, and then the next step is how do we, it's more of a rhetorical question, I guess, is how then do we disseminate this information in a way that's understandable? And I would agree with you with patients. I think we dumb stuff down way too much for the vast majority of patients.
Let's be absolutely clear. You know, what we're going to get through this process, for the most part, is not very different to the kind of evidence that we already have. It's just that we'll have all of it rather than just some of it. And it's important to be clear on that, because there are some people in industry, and some of their behavior has around this issue, I have to say, been really kind of shocking. But there are quite a few people in industry who are trying to say, if we release the results of all clinical trials, this will create confusion for the public and for professionals. It'll create panic because there'll be uncertainty about what works and what doesn't.
That's the argument that you've heard?
This is the argument made very, very seriously by senior people in industry, including the head of pharma, is it John Castellano, including the previous director general of the ABPI, Trevor Jones, that it's irresponsible because John Castellano describes it as a form of wiki regulation. I think they enjoy a system, or at least they maybe just feel comfortable with a system where regulators make decisions behind closed doors about what's best.
Is it because it's a smaller group and they're able to have influences, or what do you think the reason is, or is it just they're not forward thinking enough?
I'm not sure it can be that, actually, because I would imagine it's easier to. It's easier if your hypothesis is that they want to sort of bamboozle people and bounce them into making decisions that aren't entirely rational prescribing decisions, then I would suggest that would probably be easier with a large number of small fish than one big fish. I don't fully know. I think a lot of it actually is they are. I think they benefit from there being uncertainty about which treatment is best, because that spreads the risk. So if there's one class of medicines where one drug is clearly the best and the remainder aren't so great, the sooner that becomes clear, the tougher it is for the second, third and fourth best drug in that class. And at the moment, we kind of have almost a public subsidy for producing the third and fourth best drug in a class. Because if people don't fully recognize that because of a combination of missing data, bad trial design and aggressive marketing, then it's still possible to make a reasonable return, at least for a time and possibly forever, off the third and fourth best drug in a class. But you are exposing patients unnecessarily to the third and fourth best drug in a class in order to do that. So it's a peculiar form of public subsidy for not so much outright failure, but for producing third and fourth best drugs in class. There are people in industry who, when speaking candidly behind closed doors, basically say we need to soften what would otherwise be some quite sharp edges around the rewards for innovation. Because at the moment, you know, four people bring drugs to market. The one that's the best might get a bit more, but everybody else at least gets a fair slice of the pie. If we had perfect information about which treatment was best from the get-go, then the one that was actually the best overall in most patients would probably be used almost to the exclusion of the others. And so they would really lose out. So the gamble for innovation, am I being clear, or am I?
No, I totally get it. And it actually is.
If the market splits 40-20-20, then that's better than the market split being, 93-33 between four players. But actually, I think if we're going to have that kind of system of subsidy, we should do it without exposing patients to third and fourth best drugs in class unnecessarily. But I think that might be part of their anxiety. I think probably familiarity, ease of following rules is probably reassuring. I think more than anything else, it's they're concerned about the reputational consequences because you know, I think if you did release, if we get access to evidence from the past 23 years and we see that there were some treatments where actually the drug we thought was the best actually wasn't the best, or that some of them we could have known in 1997 that one drug in a class was not really worth using, and yet people continued to prescribe it. Then I think you get into an interesting issue around liabilities, where patients might say, well, I was on that drug for 5 years. If you're now telling me I should have been on a better drug, and that I would have been on a better drug if we hadn't had this ridiculous system where people were allowed to withhold results from doctors and patients, albeit that they gave quite a lot of them to regulators, patients might say, well, I'm angry. Now, I think in defense of industry, or not in defense of industry, but, you know, a protective factor for their anxieties about liability, I think firstly you would probably judge people by the standards of the time, and it's laughable that we've allowed people to withhold this kind of information for so long, but we have, and maybe it is reasonable to just say, look, everybody did it. But also, secondly, I think modeling the counterfactuals would be quite challenging. So, you know, the evidence changes in one class of drugs, and it turns out, you know, one was actually much worse than the others, but still better than nothing. Well, how do you model, you know, what would a typical patient have got instead of the third best drug? Would they have got the first best drug? If they had, how different would their clinical trajectory have been? How do you model that? How do you price that?
Right. But it's also, I would suggest, though, it's
so difficult. Actually, I think their fears are mislaid.
Yeah, it's really actually very, very unusual, for instance, for one statin to be better, for one ACE inhibitor to actually be clinically better. I mean, the expression is almost rare as hen's teeth, in that
I disagree, actually.
Really?
I mean, it happens. It happens. I could believe it might happen in statin world. I mean, it, you know, it may well be that the CRP hypothesis turns out to be a goer. Just trying to think, within a class, well, it's very difficult to know, isn't it? I mean, with antidepressants, with SSRIs, people say they think escitalopram is better from for example, the Cipriani network meta-analysis, but that didn't account for publication bias.
No, and better is a very, almost all of the betters, if most people, when you look at the difference, is really not clinically importantly different, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah, okay. You say that. I'm still a big believer, I have to say, in doing everything we can to optimize all of the little things, you know, to get incremental benefits, even if they're very modest, and as much as we can of medicine, I think actually can certainly have a significant impact on the population disease burden, but can also be to the good of patients. You know, if we're getting 2% benefits, but in lots and lots and lots of different areas, I think that's a good thing overall. So, I mean, I'm
certainly agree that if we can, and unfortunately, I think in medicine now we are going to be stuck with those relatively small incremental benefits because
we have been for a generation, I think, for the most part. with occasional exceptions.
No, exactly, because we've done a pretty good job of getting of dealing with, you know, the infectious diseases and sanitation stuff, and to some degree cardiovascular disease. I think we've done a pretty good job, but I think there's many reasons why that's improved.
On infectious diseases, I think I would disagree. I think we could be about to hit a very scary cliff with infectious diseases.
Oh no! What I meant was,
in the past, we've kind of, you know, the traditional narrative is we have we've plucked the low lying fruit of the pharmacological research tree, and that's certainly true.
Because I think we've had maybe one new class of antibiotics come out in the last 30 years, maybe two. And but what's really encouraging, though, and I think I know you're limited for time here, but the whole concept of even resistance in the whole area of infectious diseases, where almost all of the medical conditions that a family doc sees, we're still using the same antibiotics, and appropriately so, that we used 20 or 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, resistance is really going up.
But clinical failure is not reducing, is not, you know, when you look at the clinical trials of, like, even for pneumonia, I mean, there's still a good argument. And even in the British guidelines, the recommendation is for amoxicillin for pneumonia for, you know.
Yeah, of course.
But that's because the evidence is pretty clear that they are just as good as the newer agents. And in fact, the newer agents, as an example, you know, the macrolides and the quinolones and all that, there have been, numerous head-to-head, well-designed comparative trials showing no difference in outcomes. So, you know, we do actually have a lot of that information.
But the real issue is, you know, what can we hold back? And actually, for antibiotic resistance, I think this is another interesting example of an area where the traditional models for rewarding innovation, just as I would say with anti-diabetic medications we discussed earlier. Where I think the traditional models for rewarding innovation probably don't work very well, because most of the sort of modern exotic antibiotics sit on the shelf in a hospital. They don't get used, and for good reason. You know, we're keeping them back.
Right.
But that means that revenues are quite low, and also treatment durations are quite low. And I wonder if we need to think much more carefully about different financial models to incentivize innovation in industry, because, you know, industry, I should be absolutely clear, and I'm not, I don't know if I've said it sort of,
well, they're not a benevolent society.
Yeah, I don't think industry is sort of bad people. I think they're rule followers. I think if we create perverse incentives, they'll do perverse things. But if we align incentives sensibly with what society needs, then they do great stuff. And antibiotics, I think, is one area where we've really failed to incentivize innovation, because our payment models just sort of don't really work very well on it. I think we should be giving people a giant truck full of cash for coming up with genuinely good new antibiotics. Because remember, you know, if antibiotics go, if we have a serious problem of resistance, and we can't treat, well, let's say perioperative infections, for example, you know, operations stop, transplants stop. There's a lot of stuff that stops if we run out of antibiotics. A lot of really core medical activity goes. I feel anxious about antibiotics.
it's an interesting thing, though, because the colleague that I do the podcast with, Mike Allen, he and I just recently wrote an editorial in the BMJ about the whole concepts of antibiotic use. And I'm not trying to make light of the concept of resistance, but in talking with most of my infectious disease colleagues, the issue of resistance, with the exception of maybe methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, is primarily, you know, in the intensive care unit and in hospitals, but in the community, it's really not. We still do very, very well with the old antibiotics.
Oh, I absolutely agree, but you know, it's intensive care, transplants and operations that I'm worried about. I absolutely agree, you know, for typical chest infection, assuming nothing goes horribly, dizzyingly, bonkersly wrong.
Yeah.
And it probably won't be a traditional pneumonia infection that wipes out humanity, to be fair. But yeah, assuming nothing goes bonkersly wrong, then that's okay. But no, it's, you know, what I'm worried about is you lose your you lose your backstop antibiotics and you and ITU is gone forever. Transplants are gone forever. And I think we need to think very carefully about that strategically as a species.
No. Now you're talking more of the abstract. So I'm trying to think of a model that could possibly work for, if as a drug company you come out with a new drug that has, a new antibiotic that has a specific new mechanism of action.
We don't really need to use it.
But please don't use it. We'll give you loads of money for doing it. I mean, I'm trying to think of a system that could possibly work.
Well, maybe it's a job for kind of Gates Foundation type models. Although they're more interested.
Absolutely, yeah.
Maybe it's an issue for. I mean, people have talked about using prizes as a model rather than patents to incentivize innovation for drugs to treat conditions in the developing world. And actually, even people have talked about it for HIV.
Right.
So maybe the prizes model is one way to think about it.
You mean from this specifically for the concept of infectious disease, or just in general? I mean, even in general, you could kind of see that almost working.
Yeah. Hey,
yeah.
Look.
Yeah.
This has been a really this has been like accidentally sitting opposite a professor of pharmacy on a really boring train journey and having a great chat.
I don't know where the train's actually going, but it's been a bit of a fun ride for sure.
Right, going to finishing a paper.
I really appreciate you spending some time, and it would be actually lovely to chat with you because there's a whole bunch of other, concerns that I have in the area of therapeutics, and that almost all of the doses of medications that come on the market when the drug is first released are almost all completely wrong and all that sort of stuff. And I would love to get your feedback on that. And maybe we'll at some point set up another time. But I do want to thank you for the time. I do want to strongly encourage our listeners, and I think we have at least three. No, we have lots of them actually. To go to alltrials.net. And I must tell you that I just finished listening to your Bad Science book, and it really should be mandatory reading in any sort of university area. In fact, in any area, because you do a very good job. And anyone who talks about funnel plots in a public book deserves some sort of credit.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, if anybody's interested. Bad Science is the kind of the easy story of evidence-based medicine and how tests are run and a bit of observational epidemiology. And then Bad Pharma is not really about drug companies being dodgy. It's about the reality of how evidence-based medicine works. And it's the real meat of clinical trial design, how it can be flawed, how evidence is disseminated in medicine, and also the problem of missing trial data, which is incredibly important.
It's just really the systematic failure, if you will.
Yeah. And you know what? I have this sort of, we used to play this drunk game. I make it sound like we're the most boring people in the world. It was a one-off, really. we had this sort of epic, sort of 6-hour, 11 p.m. till 5 a.m. argument once about what aspect of current medical practice that we think is completely normal will future generations look back on with horror and amazement, in the same way that we look back on medieval doctors bloodletting or
the
50s, putting people with schizophrenia in big swings, all that kind of ridiculous stuff. What is the current aspect of medical practice that people will look back at in shock and amazement? And some of my friends' suggestions were obviously facetious, like nurse-led CBT. But actually, I think it's missing trial data. I think people will look back and they will say, you spend tens of millions of dollars, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars on each trial, trying to make sure that it's free from bias, trying to detect very modest changes in risks and benefits. And then after going to all of that effort, you let half of them get deleted from the record and you allow all of those biases to rush back in. And it just makes no sense at all. And I think people will look back, even in just 20 years, in amazement. And in particular, they'll look back at the people who did nothing, and in particular, the people who actively tried to maintain the current system. And I think well, I don't want to say anything mean, but I think those people will be regarded as being very much on the wrong side of history.
Yeah, no, I agree. The one thing that I would add to that, and again, it's one of my sort of pet peeves, is I think we've pushed the concept of surrogate markers far enough. I think we're now seeing that we've gotten to the point where aggressively lowering blood glucose does not appear to benefit that many people, if anything, maybe even harmful. I think in not too long a time, we'll go, you know what? We used to lower cholesterol, and people will laugh because I don't know. It's
but also, surrogate markers were a necessary evil in a different era of medicine where we couldn't do any better. You know, in the old days, where we wanted to get very quick answers, and it was quite difficult to follow people up for long periods of time, and most of the medicines that we looked at we were only trying to establish short-term benefits anyway. For that era of medicine, surrogate markers were a reasonable trade-off between what we wanted to achieve and what it was practical to achieve.
But I don't know if it was that it was a reasonable trade-off. It was because there was no doubt about the benefit. I mean, if you look at the very first blood pressure trials, the VA trials, the absolute benefit was in the neighborhood of 20% over 2 to 3 years. So I don't think, but the nice thing about it is that we could do that study in 3 years, and it only needed, I think, something like 70 people in each group, and you could show.
So you're right. So I guess what I'm saying is, maybe I probably didn't express it clearly enough, but what I mean is, back then, we wanted to measure very dramatic differences that appeared quite rapidly, and so the fact that we had to rely on paper records to follow people up, which made it very difficult and expensive to follow people up for long periods of time, that didn't really matter because we didn't need to follow up large numbers of people for a long period of time. Today, we can follow up large numbers of people through their electronic health records for basically almost no cost for very long periods of time. So there's no longer any excuse for not doing so. And at the same time, we're trying to measure often very modest differences between two treatments that only become apparent after a long period of time. Now, given the fact that we have the facility to measure real-world outcomes, and given the fact that we have the need to measure real-world outcomes, I think there is no excuse for persisting in this absurd situation where we rely so much on surrogate outcomes. It's senseless, and it's a very interesting example, I think, of how legacy systems can persist in a culture, i.e. the culture of medicine, not because they make sense, but just because they're what everyone's used to. And I think it's interesting to me that I feel like we couldn't change this very easily in medicine because everybody's basically satisfied and unambitious with the current scenario. And I kind of feel like the only way to change it, perversely, is by engaging the public. And that's why I wrote possibly the most ridiculously long and complicated pop science book that anyone has ever seen in Bad Pharma. Because I just sort of feel really frustrated that, you know, you and I can have a sensible conversation, and anyone listening to this could pretty much follow it, regardless of what they did for a living. There are all these obvious shortcomings in the systems that we use that are obviously remediable. And I think if policymakers and the public were more aware of them, I think they'd be really annoyed at our complacency as a profession in not fixing them.
No, I totally agree. And I think, Ben, you've been very, very kind. I know we started off saying that we'd chat for about 25 minutes, and we've gone on for quite a bit longer than that. So I know you need to get back to do some of your stuff. So no, I very much endorse and support what you're trying to do in regards to, you know, this dissemination of information, which is kind of my sort of area. But almost more importantly is trying to solve the problem of, like you said, of either missing trial data, or how do we answer the right questions using sort of the pragmatic randomized trial. So I strongly support the you continue to push on that envelope, if you will, and hopefully
Just by the by, because links are difficult in podcasts, if anybody wants to read about the pragmatic randomized trials, it's either chapter 5 in Bad Pharma, or if you're a pro, it's if you Google BMJ Goldacre 2012 STAR, STAA, he's one of the co-authors, in fact he's the lead author, that will get the paper.
Yeah. I'll put every one of the links, almost every one of the links that we've talked about in right into the on our website, so people can get access to it. And but alltrials.net is pretty simple.
And alltrials.net is just it's so important. You know, future generations will be unimpressed if you don't sign.
Yeah, good. No, I totally agree. So we'll try and hopefully by you letting even more people know, we'll get more people signing up. And so, no, that's very kind of you, Ben. And it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thanks, boss. Great fun. And you should get John Yudkin on. He was my first ever consultant, but he's a great guy. We're doing a paper together at the moment. And he's very good on diabetes and UK PDS.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'll definitely do that. So I think we'll leave it at that. And thanks, as always, for listening.
You've been listening to the Tech Podcast. We welcome any...